So, Tim, were you a bad kid?
Was I a bad kid?
Yeah, were you a bad kid?
I mean, my mom does listen to the show on a regular basis, so I don't know that I'm going to, like, totally answer that question.
Did you ever get caught for anything?
Did I ever get caught for anything?
Did you go to the principal's office?
Yes. Not for anything exciting. I got one detention for, like, skipping class to go to lunch in high school. So, not... Yes, I know. I'm a boring guy. We've established
you
this.
You said it, not me.
All right, so your turn. Did you get in trouble a lot, Camille? Bad girl?
No. Nope.
Miskity two-shoes, then.
Hey, I always have good shoes.
Says the woman with a fashion blog.
Right, right. But let's get serious.
Okay.
So neither one of us got labeled the bad kid.
No.
When we were growing up.
Nope. But you know, many kids do carry around that label, bad, earning suspensions as early as kindergarten. And the data show that the majority of them are black, especially in Missouri. And the research shows that those students who've been suspended are more likely to fail in school, drop out, and even get in trouble with the law.
So, Tim, you and I have been digging into the numbers for the past few weeks, and we've seen a lot of sobering statistics.
Yes, we have.
Like the fact that even though black students account for only 16% of the student population, last year they got 40% of the suspensions in Missouri.
And the data show it's been that way for a really long time. And those are just a couple of big picture findings from a series of stories you and I are working on about the disproportionate number of black students being suspended in Missouri.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I cover education stories a lot. And I've never heard of or talked to any teacher or administrator who says they're out to treat white kids differently than black kids, or rich kids differently than poor kids, for that matter.
But the numbers speak for themselves.
So what's going on here?
So during our reporting, we keep bringing this up to educators, and they keep telling us the same thing. Untangling school discipline as it relates to race a lot of times has nothing to do with the kids and everything to do with their own personal journey.
So on this episode, four stories of educators coming to grips with issues of race, poverty, and discipline in the classroom.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race, class,
power, poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Okay, so before we get to story number one, let's just go ahead and get something out of the way, and we need to set our audio levels.
And I'll let you in on a little radio magic secret. We do this by asking the same question at the start of every interview.
And what is that question you ask?
What did you have for breakfast?
Oh, breakfast, graham crackers. How about that?
And that doesn't sound.
That's all I've had. I'm headed to Chipotle, though, for lunch.
Oh, man.
You're Chipotle.
Exactly.
Camille's a Qdoba fan.
Yeah.
We've had this discussion.
Yeah. Only because I have a buy one, get one free card for Chipotle. That's it.
This is Bob Dylan.
Wait, Bob Dylan?
Yeah, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan?
Yeah. Well, not officially.
Dr. Robert Dylan currently serves as the Director of Innovation for the Afton School District, and have now served communities and children in St. Louis for 20 years as a teacher and then principal, and now is Director of Innovation.
So for the first part of that 20 years, almost all of the kids he served were white. He's from the St. Louis area, and like we talk about all the time on this show, the region is really segregated. So mostly he grew up around other white kids, and he went to a college with almost exclusively white classmates.
Then a couple of years into his career, he took an assistant principal job at Knifer Middle School in Kirkwood, where about one in four students are black. And for the first time, Bob, a white teacher from a white part of St. Louis, had to start really thinking about race.
It was a very different place in regards to how race interacted with each other. I often talked about how there were really two worlds that were circling around each other but never intersected. There was the African-American community that was in the same school with a very affluent white community for the most part, and friends at school. But you knew at Friday at 3 o'clock, people were returning to very different places and having very different experiences and having very different opportunities. And coming back from summer break, the conversations were very different. And so I recognized that and tried really hard to figure out how to crack that nut and figure out how to build some conversations. But I realized that for many folks, they've got to figure out their own stuff before they can start building out solutions. And so that's what I tried to do in that space in Kirkwood, was really try to figure out my own biases, the things that were under the surface of those mental models that I probably ignored for a number of years or had been built out by, you know, previous generations, my grandparents, my parents, and all those things that normally shape who you are.
How did you do that, and what were the biases that you figured out that you had?
That's a good question. Kirkwood at that point in time was really building out some cohorts of individuals that were having some really tough conversations. We partnered with the Alton School District, where they have a larger number of African-American teachers. And we got together and had some really tough conversations about white privilege and, you know, structural racism. And all of a sudden, that started to change and open a new lens. I think that I had a really surface-level understanding of poverty, of what that meant. And also, I tended to make excuses for parents, like, what, they don't care about their kids? Why won't they come to school? And those types of comments that come along with that. And it's almost embarrassing to say some of that stuff now, but that was the reality at the time. So I'm not embarrassed by where I was then. The, you know, things like that are, you know, why do these students have really nice shoes, but they can't buy their school supplies? Why?
When you say these students, what do you mean?
Students of color, the students that were coming to us from Meacham Park area primarily when I was in Kirkwood. And so, you know, that type of language, even having that type of language that was just a normal flow of who you are, that you didn't even stop when those things were coming out of your mouth. I think that what I found was that I was starting then to hear other people say it, and then I realized that sounds like me, and that's not where I want to be. And so it was really important for me to have those types of conversations where we were saying, you don't get it. It's deeper than that. And a lot of reading, a lot of digging into things that I hadn't been exposed to in regards to, you know, how race really impacts a lot of things that I just ignored before.
Okay, so Bob is starting to have this awakening, if you will, and he's doing it while he's an assistant principal.
And we should note that assistant principals are usually the disciplinarians in schools. So we asked Bob if this awakening started to change how he handled kids who wound up in his office.
There were a couple differences I saw in how I handled myself. One, I really worked hard to de-escalate students when they were in my office, as opposed to feeling like I was stepping into a confrontation. Started to find myself taking a much longer period of time to work with students. I wouldn't say counseling, but listening, trying to understand students at a deeper level. And then also some teaching as a principal to say, you know, I know that this situation happened. No one's to blame. Let's try to figure out how to keep yourself from doing that in the future. And trying to give students some ideas on how to not press that extra bit with the teacher, or how to find ways to de-escalate once they were in the principal's office. And so I felt like a much greater responsibility after that introspection period to really work with students to help them for the next time, as opposed to just thinking about the consequence for what did happen. I don't know if it felt like at the time, like I don't know if I can go back and say, yeah, I can point to these two or three places where I was really insensitive. But I certainly had a lens going forward that reminded me often, man, this is more complicated than whatever's written on this referral. This is more complicated than any anger that a teacher just had towards that child. This is more complicated. And so I just kept coming back to, like, if you can understand this at a deeper level, then maybe on good days you can get a sense of how to move forward. We just have to keep having as many conversations as possible about the fact that there's still a lot of work to do in that area. And, you know, I think we deserve schools that are treating all kids in a way that's fair.
Do you find that, especially with what's gone on in the last year, that there are more white educators and white teachers who are ready to have the conversation or ready to go on the journey that you went on 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think there's a really high interest and a really high anxiety level. coupled together. I do know that people want to have a better understanding. They're afraid to look ignorant. They're afraid to say, I don't get it, because then there's two things that get put around their head and they struggle with this. Well, if you don't get it, you're a racist. If you don't get it, how can you possibly help my kid? And those come from a lot of different pressures. Those don't just come from African-American pressures, but they come from, you know, your colleagues. And I think that's the anxiety level that's there.
It always strikes me that, you know, I talk to educators a lot in all different, you know, in all different settings. And I've never come across an educator who wants to ever believe in any way that they are doing something that would treat one group of students different than another group of students. And it gets to that point that this is, that I think that you were trying to make, that this isn't about somebody, you know, being just a flat out racist. They're not walking through their the halls of their school throwing out the N-word or something like that. But how do you, I mean, how do you begin to unlock, you know, make it safe for white educators especially to begin thinking about these issues and not just thinking about them personally, but thinking about them on the system level?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think that folks can always say, let's talk more about it. But, you know, what are we going to put into action? And I think that's a real question for schools, is that we're really good about talking about things in general in education, but the action piece isn't there. So I would be looking for two or three action steps that we would be asking all of our teachers to do and that go beyond conversation. And one of those would be to visit schools with much more diversity, like walk through the halls, understand what that looks like and feels like, everything from the learning environment, to the volume of students in a classroom, to the resources that may or may not exist. And, you know, I catch myself all the time saying that almost all of our teachers visit two schools, the one they teach at and the one where their kids go to school. There's just a lot of fear in the system. And we need, as white educators, someone to give us permission to mess up and to be able to say, hey, getting on this journey is going to be about risk-taking, and we're not going to knock you down the first time you make a mistake, because that's the fear, is that you're going to say something wrong. You know, I'm sitting here in front of this microphone thinking, man, I said something wrong, but, you know, I'm trying to push through that and, you know, apologize if you have to and be sincere about it, but you can't be in a situation where people are ready to really chop you when you make that first mistake around race relations or a tough conversation, or you're saying, I don't see my white privilege. And someone goes, what do you mean you don't see your white privilege? It's right. It's obvious. And they blow up on you. The conversation's over at that point in time. And so having someone say you have permission to fail around this, because short-term failure means long-term gain, is going to go a long way. I don't know how someone has the power to just say, you have permission, but I think that a lot of folks are waiting for that permission.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Who gives you permission? Black people?
I don't know. Like your boss, your community? Certainly that helps if people of color say, you know what, if we get into this conversation and you say something dumb, I'm not going to think that you're an ignorant racist. Yes, that helps. But I don't know that there are white people just sitting around waiting for permission to join the conversation, and waiting for black people to say, come on, let's talk about race. But someone needs to give you that permission, because people have a huge fear. White people have a huge fear of being seen as that racist that's doing the wrong thing, that isn't treating kids well. I mean, you want to go right to the heart of a teacher. You say, I'm going to point out four or five things you do every day that is bad for kids. Those conversations don't go well. So, and then you layer race on top of that, and man, that's a toxic environment you're creating in a lot of spaces.
So what do you think about when someone points out something that's going wrong in the system?
Yeah, a lot of people are ducking and covering and running as fast as they can. When I hear those things through the lens that I have personally, it makes me pause. And and start to look deeper and say, you know, this data point isn't about this data point. It's about a system. It's about a structure. It's about a mental model. And I dig deeper when I hear those things.
You know, listening back to Bob tell his story, I wonder if it's easier to think about race in education if you went to a more diverse school growing up. That takes us to story number two, and it comes from Rachel Ward. Her official job title is Coordinator of Assessment and Instructional Coach, which basically means she looks through data and observes teachers, then gives them feedback.
She works in the Maplewood-Richmond Heights School District, which is a relatively diverse place by St. Louis standards. About 26% of students there are Black and 59% are white. Rachel also went to school in the district from kindergarten until she graduated high school in 2002.
And I remember, and I still feel this way, that when I was a student here, we were just one big family. I was part of that family. I used to say or believe that I didn't see color. I always, you know, bragged or loved the diversity and the family-like feel here at MRH. And I still feel like that exists. But when I left, I went to school at Mizzou, and it wasn't as obviously diverse as MRH was. And then when I came back as a teacher, I started to see a little bit more. I guess I saw a little bit of a bigger picture. I had, you know, all the students in my classroom, not just my group of friends or whatnot when I was a student here. And I started to see that there was a lot of diversity, but it wasn't quite as, it wasn't just one huge family. There may have been a couple little families running around here at MRH than what I imagined when I was a student. And now in my role, I have the whole district perspective. The shift that's happened for me is that we really need to be deliberate about taking a look and identifying at what different injustices might be happening with our students and trying to address those to the best that we can so that we meet the needs of all of our students.
And tell me about those specifically when you say injustices, what you mean when race isn't part of the equation.
When you're looking at race, I think it's just making sure you look at academic, the success of our students and making sure that, you know, across the board, all of our students have an equal opportunity to education and that we are, there are no doors that are being closed for anybody, for some part of them that we aren't acknowledging, I guess.
You know, when I listen to you talk, it kind of reminds me a little bit of myself. We're sort of like being raised in this sort of quasi post-racial world that you know, you're sort of taught that you should be colorblind. But then you realize, you know, as you get older that, well, no, hold on a second. Race is an issue, that race does matter. And I wonder if you kind of reach that same sort of realization in your own life.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like I said, I used to kind of brag that, you know, I don't see color. We're just one big family. Everybody loves everybody. But then looking back, reflecting on like when I was a teacher, I wish that I was more deliberate at like when I looked at my groups, when I looked at my data to make sure that I really was meeting the needs of all of my students. And I don't know if I was or wasn't because I didn't do a very good job back then at least my first couple years of teaching at making sure that I was really deliberate about, okay, let's make sure that I've met their needs and their needs, you know. I just was like, oh, they're all my students and I meet the needs of all my students. I do the best I can. I differentiate. But it would have been really, I think it would have been good for me to look at actual data and make sure that that really was happening and have those conversations. And I think the other piece is just learning about what, I always say, what you don't know. Like, you don't know what you don't know. And so just having those conversations and having those really hard conversations and learning about the different perspectives and learning about the different injustices that might be happening and the history behind some of them and what we can do to break that cycle.
Okay, so we need to push pause for a moment and tell you how some of that learning began.
Because unlike Bob, who spent more than a decade contemplating these concepts, Rachel, like many people in the St. Louis area, really didn't get that deep into this until after Ferguson. In fact, it was during an intense 3-day retreat last summer where things really started to click.
That's where it kind of all came together for me, where I realized all the different pieces and aspects of what I've done before and what I do now are all coming together at this really pivotal time to make sure that we keep these conversations going.
I guess one thing I'm wondering about, too, is, I mean, when you think about, we're talking a lot about the discipline gap, but even other racial gaps, you know, the achievement gap, the attendance gap, the graduation gap, it goes on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, you're obviously a numbers person. I mean, you knew that those gaps existed. So what was it about that retreat that sort of flipped the switch for you, do you think?
I think it kind of, I guess, this is only my second year in this position. And last year I kind of got this like, oh, this is how it is. Isn't that, like, look at this gap. This is how it is. Isn't that sad? Isn't that awful? But I feel like the retreat really was kind of a turning point where it was like, oh, if we can just have these conversations and educate and make some changes, we can change this gap. I guess it was kind of like an inspiring, hopeful, let's go get them. Let's get this, you know, let's close this gap or at least see what we can do. And I think it also was, we've always talked about closing the achievement gap. We've always talked about that. But I feel like that was one of the first times that we really hit on the root of the issue and what we need to do to close that achievement gap.
What was the root of the issue that you hit on?
The identifying the biases that everybody has and really acknowledging those and seeing what we can do. How does that impact what I do on a daily basis? And how can we make changes and put systems into place that are equitable and ensure equity?
I imagine that had to have been, in some respects, a little painful for you as someone who felt like that she was socially aware.
Yeah, no, it was like I said, a very intense couple of days for a lot of us. But it wasn't easy to really think and acknowledge what are some things that I have done that I wasn't even aware of, or things that I haven't done that I wasn't aware of.
Do you remember what some of those, you know, what the tone of those conversations or some of the topics that came up?
Well, there were a lot, but with race specifically, it was just about like the institutionalized racism, I guess, here, especially here in St. Louis, that we really looked at. That to me just, it was a little depressing at first, but then it was like, how do I play into that and what can I do? And just one of them was just, you know, making eye contact and being acknowledging and being respectful of everybody. And so I've just really been trying to be aware of how I think and interact and asking myself those tough questions. Like, what was your initial thought when you had that conversation with this person? Or, you know, and just being aware of any judgments that I might hold and trying to figure out why they're there and get rid of them if I can. I guess something about that retreat told me that was a good thing, to be feeling that uncomfortable, that awkward, I guess, or uncomfortable feeling. That is a good thing. And that is what needs to happen for change to happen.
The push to look at data with a clearer lens on racial disparities is still pretty new for Rachel, so it's too early to know how much of a difference this will make.
But she says recognizing race's influence in the classroom is the first step towards solving the problem. So far, we've talked to two educators, both white, about their journeys coming to terms with race and how that plays out in the classroom. For Bob Dylan, he was working as a white man in a mostly white school. At Maplewood Richmond Heights, Rachel Ward is a white woman working in a relatively diverse school.
But we know most schools in the St. Louis area aren't that diverse, but most teachers are white. So what's it like for a white teacher in a mostly African-American school? That brings us to our third story, and it starts like this. A white guy with big bushy hair and beard, think Jerry Garcia, walks into a classroom full of 15-year-old black kids.
This is the first time I've been the only white guy in a room before.
Oh, yeah. We did forget to introduce who's actually, like, doing the talking here.
Yeah. That was Jacob Biedemchek, a lit teacher at University City High School. More than 80% of the students there are black.
And now that we got that out of the way, let's get back to the story of his first days in the classroom, which happened just a couple of years ago.
It was really exciting for me because I didn't, you know, people always act like, you read stuff like people like, oh, the first time I was the first white guy in a room, I was really nervous or something. And when you read, you know, stuff like this about teachers and environments like that. And I was really excited about it because it was a totally normal classroom. with normal stuff, normal everything. Like, they had a smart board and books, and nothing was weird. And then he came in, and they were having a really fantastic conversation about, I think it was Romeo and Juliet. I think it was a freshman course, and they were talking about Romeo and Juliet. And hearing kids using casual vernacular that they would use anywhere at home or with their friends or whatever, but applying, you know, actually understanding what the book is about and having really interesting conversations about it. That was when I decided that, like, oh, this is a place I really enjoy being. This was like the first or second day I was there. And so I started to focus on how just because a group of students doesn't look like what people think an academic group of students looks like doesn't mean it's not a robust academic experience.
Were there any of your own biases that you immediately realized, I better start unpacking these now, otherwise I'm going to have a problem?
I think I did that really early. I think the biggest problem I had was what a colleague of mine told me was like white guilt. Like every time something, I would have a conflict with a student, I think I would blame myself first. I'd, you know, say like, oh, I'm just, expecting them to do something that like is unrealistic or something. And I think I very early, probably before I actually got paid to work there, started to unpack, I like how you put that, unpack those anxieties. And I treat teaching as a form of social justice. I think me agreeing to be there and agreeing to try to do my job well is important. And I think the kids know that. I think the kids more often see me as an adult in their school building. I think most of them treat school as a safe place before they think of me as just some white guy. Communicating that was difficult, I think, for me originally, though. Communicating to them that I'm in charge, I'm in a position of supervision over this classroom. It's my job to make sure that you know how to read when you leave here and that you can write an essay coherently. And in order to do that, we have to maintain some order. And I think I was originally afraid to establish that order because I didn't want to seem like some overbearing white guy in a class full of 15-year-old black kids. But I really don't have that problem anymore. I found the way to do that where we can be on the same page. Because, I mean, honesty is really the best thing. I think a lot of people play down to kids. And that's really, you really start to lose effective communication with them. If, you know, you're a black student starting off high school in a new building and you have a white teacher and a white principal, and your natural response when you sit down is to start talking to your friend next to you. And your teacher says, hey, let's not do that. Let's do this right now. But you're 15. You're very impulsive. You're very excited to see your friend. You spend all this time waiting to see your friend at home the night before. And so you start working and you start talking to your friend again. You get another warning. Hey, quit talking to that person and focus on your thing. And then that happens over and over again. Eventually, this could happen to anybody. It's happened to me all the time as a white kid with a bunch of other white kids. But, you know, you get reprimanded for being off task. Maybe this happens repeatedly. Eventually, a principal gets involved. And then maybe you get, like, an after-school detention or something. You're being taught that your natural behavior in the classroom is unnatural and unwanted. And if it's white adults communicating that to you and you're a young black student, that communicates a message, maybe just subconsciously, but that communicates a racially aggravating message. If to be told, you know, by white authority that as a young black student that your natural behavior is unwanted or unwelcome there. And so then we don't have this problem in my building that we notice as far as, like, we talked about the disparity with suspensions, but suspensions, my problem with suspensions is this kid is doing something other than learning and it's disrupting other kids' learning. So he gets in trouble, and the solution is pull him out of class so he gets even further behind, which doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think explain it that way to the students. They say, we're going to make you more behind. They don't do that. But the student's already distracted and already not learning. And that's why you want them to quit doing that behavior in the first place, because you want them to learn. And then they cross some kind of a line and they get suspended, they're just going to keep not learning. No matter how much work you send home, nothing can recreate a positive classroom environment. And I think that's that same thing. It's the same thing saying that your behavior is unacceptable, so we're going to alienate you further from the classroom. And if you're a black minority in a mostly white school, that must be, I can't imagine how difficult that must be. To be communicated those things. And kids don't articulate them like that. Kids don't know to say that, oh, I feel alienated.
But they know that they don't feel welcome.
Yeah, they know the feeling. They definitely feel all that stuff. They might not know how to articulate it, but yeah, they definitely feel those things. They don't sit around and say, oh, I feel alienated because, you know, my natural behavior is unwelcome in the learning environment. They would never say that. If a kid said that, I'd be freaked out. I'd be like, don't talk like that. You're 15. That's weird. But that's definitely the feeling they're getting. That's definitely the message being communicated to them subconsciously, I think.
So there's an obvious question here. Do issues of race disappear if the teacher does look like his or her students? For that, we turn to our final story.
I'm Lisa Gray. I'm a teacher at Normandy High School, and I teach ninth grade reading.
Lisa's been in Normandy for the past 9 years. She's been a teacher for 20 years.
3 years ago, Normandy lost its state accreditation, and a year after that, a judge upheld a law that allowed students to transfer to an accredited district.
Now, in Normandy, almost all the students are Black, and it's surrounded by concentrated poverty.
Normandy officials picked Francis Howell, a mostly affluent, mostly white school district in St. Charles County, as the only place where transfer students could get a bus ride to school.
And during an infamous meeting at Francis Howell High School, some parents, like Beth Sarami, made comments like this.
I want to know where the metal detectors are going to be, and I want to know where your drug-sniffing dogs are going to be, and I want, this is what I want the same security that Normandy gets when they walk through their school door.
Many took comments like that made during the meeting as being nothing short of racist. And teacher Lisa Gray says the perception that her students are inherently dangerous is not only painful, it's far from the truth.
Just the name Normandy, people on the outside, they don't want to know the kids. And my thing is, if you haven't built that relationship with those children, you'll never know that they're the sweetest, nicest kids that you'll ever meet.
I wonder, though, like, again, how if you get that sense of how the way students feel like they're perceived outside of Normandy as being somehow how do you feel like that impacts them, impacts their own self-image?
Well, if I was a student there, it would make me feel sad that someone is constantly talking about my school, you know, making my school and the district look bad. I love where I am, and I love what I do, and I love the kids, because if I didn't, I wouldn't be there.
It almost feels like when I, just hearing you talk and being in the room with you when that topic comes up, I can tell that hits home.
Yep.
That's
sensitive.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yep. Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm good.
Okay. I mean, you obviously care a lot about your kids.
Yep. And where I work.
Do you think that people assume that because you are a Black teacher, that you'll have a certain type of relationship with Black students?
Yes and no. Just because we look alike doesn't mean that we all have the same interests in the kids' education, their future, or any of that, or even just to find out what they like. 'Cause for me, I could tell you where every student sits for every class period. Things that interest them, things, the sports that they play. I mean, I could tell you, you know, a little bit because, you know, I tell them all the time, I'm like your mother while you're here. And so I'm your mom away from your mom, basically.
So we know that sometimes moms, you know, moms have to discipline us. Moms have to get after us if we act out. How does that translate for you in the classroom? What's your approach to discipline?
Well, like I said, it's the building the relationship piece. Once you build that relationship, they know that once they're being reprimanded about anything, you know, in class, they respect that I have to, you know, discipline them, but it's, you know, they comply.
I wonder, like, if there's ever a time where you know a kid who's, because obviously so much of what you do in your classroom is all about building relationships with students and really getting to know them. if there's ever a time when a student's come into your class and, you know, for whatever reason, they've gotten in trouble before, they've earned the quote-unquote bad kid label, do you reach out more to that student and try and connect with that student a little bit more? Or how do you begin to sort of let a student, even though maybe perhaps they've earned this quote-unquote bad kid label, that they have value in your classroom and they're welcome there?
First of all, if they're bad somewhere else, doesn't mean they're going to be bad with me. Because the teacher next door down the hall says something, oh, this kid is bad, you have to have your own perception. Just, you know, greet them, have them to come in, you know, just let them know openly that, hey, you know, I care about you. And then, you know, you develop your own judgment against that kid if, you know, this is a bad kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things we've been talking to white teachers who have been telling us about their journeys, kind of tapping into maybe some of their own misperceptions that they have about people of color. And once they realize those, being like, I didn't even realize I was doing that. And even if they were like deeply locked in, that it's changed the way that they approach their classrooms and it changed the way that they deal with discipline. Instead of just assuming, oh, you know, this kid is just, you know, little Johnny's just acting up today and annoying me, they're like, wait, let me pause here. Maybe what am I bringing to this? Does hearing that there's a lot of teachers out there, specifically white teachers, who are kind of having this awakening, does any of that surprise you?
Not really. Because people that look like me, that teach kids that look like me, have biases too. So they, you know, like I said, it just depends on the person. Because you're an African-American teacher teaching African-American kids doesn't mean that you have a strong management system, or doesn't mean that you can reach the kids. It depends on the person. So if, like I said, if you're not genuine about what you do, no matter if you're, you know, African-American, Caucasian, Hispanic, whatever, you have to... The kids know when you're faking. They know. They pick it up. They sense it. So if you don't genuinely care about them, they'll know it day one.
One of the things that we've also been talking with people about is, quite frankly, that for a lot of white educators, they're now thinking or doing a lot of work in terms of how race and poverty plays out perhaps in their classrooms or in their own biases that maybe they were not aware of. What do you think about all this conversation about that happening as a black teacher who's teaching at a place, who's teaching a lot of black students? What do you think about all this conversation going on around these issues?
It's sad. That's all I can say. It's sad. I wish we wouldn't have to have these conversations, but it's there. I just, you know, I teach my own children to not build or develop stereotypes against people, and I also talk to my students about the same thing.
You said it's sad. I mean...
It's sad to have this have the conversation about, you know, being biased, the race issue, things of that nature. It's just sad to even know that things of that nature is still going on, you know, as of today in 2015, that people, you know, look at you weird. I walk, you know, in the store and... Caucasian lady grabs her purse. She makes the perception that, oh my God, this black lady is about to steal my bag. So, you know, it's just sad that the race issue hasn't gone away.
talking from the heart, but what she's saying is backed up by the numbers. Like we told you at the top of the show, we've been going through year after year of data on student suspensions in Missouri.
So here's one more stat for you to think about. School districts in St. Louis City and County handed out almost 63,000 suspensions last school year alone. Almost 51,000 of those went to Black students.
Another way to think about those numbers, about 44% of all the students in St. Louis City and County districts are Black, yet they received almost 81% of the suspensions. That means a lot of Black kids are getting that bad kid label.
So next time on We Live Here, what does it mean to be Black and earn the label bad kid, sometimes as early as kindergarten?
We Live Here is produced by me, Camille Stanley.
And me, Tim Lloyd. Shula Newman is our editor, and Margaret Freivogel is the editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
Our theme music is composed by Cassie Morgan.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.